come and say, you know, what can I even speak about this talk? Eventually, you know, we're talking to different people, we decided that this would be an interesting subject. Can you hear me? This would be an interesting subject to talk about the uses of plants, traditionally used plants, both here in Africa, in China, and in Europe, in some of the places that I've had exposure and I've traveled in and looked at these plants. So by the end of this, I'll judge the success of this talk. If everyone here in this room wants to be a traditional healer, then I would have been really successful. To tell you about the presentation, as I said, that it will look at cultural beliefs both in Africa, China, and in Europe, with special emphasis here in Southern Africa. So we'll look at plants later on after our overview, charms, we'll look at incense, we'll look at purgatives, hallucinogenic plants, and aphrodisiacs. I've chosen these different areas because there's a lot of common threads that runs along, but there's much more plants and areas of interest and areas of use as well. I'll also touch a little bit on placebo effects and medicinal plants' association with shape, characteristics of plants, morphological characteristics of plants. So at the end of the talk, we'll, if you want to ask some questions, I'll make myself available to answer a few questions. So what do we know about plants? Our fossil record tells us that, you know, people, humans, have been using plants for over 60 million years. And they've used plants for different things, for food, medicine, crafts, and so on and so on. But medicine is quite an important thing. We all need medicine to be healthy. We all need medicine for different things, although it's different approach in all different cultures, whether you're from the East, whether you're from originally from Africa or originally from Europe, plants are plants. That's the common threads in humans. So before we get to explain more about plants and so on, I wanted to touch on the traditional knowledge. Because traditional knowledge is quite an important thing. It informs us on how people live, their cultural ways, and it's the way they relate to the environment, it's the way they believe in things, and they accumulate this knowledge, which today, in a lot of instances, has helped science advance. So this knowledge is normally handed down. How is it handed down? Through verbal communication, through written. Mostly in Europe, in the last 400 years, a lot of things have been written down. So knowledge has been quite consistent. In Africa, mostly it's been verbal communication, handing off information down. In Asia, it's very different. It's because their writing and their system is much more different. It's even longer. Some information dating as back to about 3 to 5,000 BC. So it's quite an interesting to look at these three different systems that have evolved separately, and in the last 200 years or so, last 400 to 500 years have come together and build on this knowledge that we have currently. To talk about the word muti, you know, a lot of people know this word. It's a Nguni word. We call it umuti normally, or for a plural, imiti. It can mean good or bad, you know. So for people who believe in good medicine that heals you, that makes you strong and so on, that would be good medicine. For people who believe in bad medicine, it would make things negative for your circumstances. So in Africa a lot, that in that context of good and bad medicine, it exists very, very strongly, whereas I think in Europe there is, but not as much. And I've tried to pitch the talk and look at much more earlier times and earlier examples. I've gone back to Victorian times and even longer than that, so that we can get a better understanding. Currently, we know that 80% of the of the population in Africa and in most developing countries use traditional medicine. You can imagine that 80% of the population. I'll give you some figures later about us here in South Africa, how much our population is are using. And all of these plants, the reality is that they are not necessarily cultivated in monoculture. They're harvested in the wild. They come from the wild. And a lot of the users that use this plant believe that when they come from the wild, they are much more potent than plants that are more cultivated. So we have quite a challenge in that statement that I've just made. In South Africa, think about this. In the early last century, let's say in 1910, our population was less than 10 million in South Africa. And today, our population is 50 plus million. You can imagine how much pressure is that in the wild. And some of these customs haven't changed. People still use the plants and so on and so on. This is not only unique here. In places like China as well, they've got the same challenges. So what are these plants? Why are people so keen on them? What are they looking at them? In the last 200 years, there's been a lot of efficacy testing through Western science, looking at plants, what do they have. And it's been divided into these chemical compounds, which are called alkaloids and glycosides. What are these alkaloids? We know that currently, there might be even more as we speak, that there's more than 3,000 and that have been identified from more than 4,000 plants. If you taste them, sometimes they're a little bit, they make the plant bitter. And, you know, they act on the nervous systems and they produce physiological, psychological effects in our bodies when we take them. And this is important, that, you know, something that is a medicine can be a toxin as well. So if you think about it, if today you were to take paracetamol, If you take one, your headache will go away. But if you take 10, you might, end up in the hospital. So in traditional medicine, it's the same principle that dosage is key. So you have to know that. As well, the glycosides, that we know that they more sugar, the sugar molecule, that's more dominant there compared to the alkaloids. So, as the plants, the medicinal plants, they have many compounds that we find useful as humans, that our body react to in different ways, from the vitamins and nitrogen and so on, and which produce and act with our body, producing anti-inflammatory, anti-tubers, so these things. In the long term, one has to test them, for their efficacy, which is what is a lot of work that now is doing that. It's interesting, this fact that most of the plants that we use, of the medicine, conventional medicine that we have, 25% of it comes from plants. These are plants that obviously have come from traditionally used plants, whether it's here in Africa, whether it's Asia, and in Europe, and in other parts of the world. I just decided to contain it, to focus on these three areas, because I'm a little bit more familiar with them. But South America has given us a lot of plants as well. But so these plants have been, while we say it's 25%, it's growing all the time. In Europe, the industry, this is what it's worth in 2003-2004, which is quite substantial. Let me show you in China how much it's worth. And what do you think here in Southern Africa it's worth? So it's quite a big industry, and it's growing all the time. And as I told you before, that this industry, most of it, it's not plants that are cultivated. It's plants that are harvested in the wild. So you can imagine the pressure in the wild. Let me paint a much more clearer picture of the southern and South African, especially, case scenario. We know that here, before I give you that, that here in South Africa, does anyone know, first, before I give you, I tell you more about these facts, about the Inyangas? Has anyone heard of that name? Probably? Yes. Let me explain it. I will go into it later, even much more. In Africa, there's traditionally, there is Inyangas, which are more herbalist people that normally would train under someone and they would learn the crafts. There's Isangoma, which is more of a divine healer. They are more spiritual people. Although these days in urban setting you find a cross of the two, which is it's a very rare thing traditionally to find, but you do find quite a lot of also fly-by-night people. So in South Africa alone, we have about 2,000 traditional healers. The figures, as you see here, that there are so many households that are dependent on that income. And I'll explain to you later how this dependency comes. And There's 27 million consumers, and of course, 72% of our population use traditional medicine. These are plants that come from the wild. These are plants that. These are plants that these quantities, these 35 to 70 tons of plants that come out of the wild annually. And now in South Africa, we've got two major medicinal multi-market. Our plant cultural industry is based mainly in Durban and in Johannesburg. In Johannesburg, there's a market called Faraday, which is in central Johannesburg. Those of you who know Faraday train station, it's not too far from there. In Durban, it's in also almost the center of town. And you see a lot of the plants that come from different parts of Southern Africa, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, and to all the internal, and they end up there and being sold, and that equates to that. And the plant species that are used, the quantities, and so on, you can see the how much they are, about 700. 95% of this is, you know, unprocessed. But what's very interesting is that, you know, most of these plants, 86% of these plants, they'll always end up drying up or dying. You know, they won't survive when they've harvested them. That's quite an issue. What's the economics in this? We know that there's about 500 to 1 billion, the industry is worth that in South Africa. About 2.9 billion sales in medicines to consumer. And it continues that there's 3 billion annual traditional medicine. That equals to about 5% of our health budget in South Africa. This figure is mainly extracted from Miles Mander's work, who did some quantifying work in the early mid-2000s. Now, I wanted to sketch this scenario on how one trades on this, how the trade is conducted here in South Africa especially. So, normally in the rural area, Eastern Cape, Limpopo, KwaZulu-Natal, even locally but on a very small scale, a person who's unemployed, who doesn't normally have skills in urban setting to survive, would see it as an easy opportunity to go and dig up the plants. And the plants are normally sold to a broker, someone who has a vehicle who can rush them off to an urban area. And when the plant broker gets there, he sells them to a person who's got a store. But in some other cases, there would be a plant in between a person who would buy a big consignment and distribute it. But some other traders would buy it from the plant broker initially. So when it gets to the market, now it's on the floor in the market, people, they buy. Some people who are knowledgeable about plants, who come from rural areas, would buy the plant and self-medicate. They know the dosage. The plants are also sold to traditional healers, but this is not true in every case. A lot of traditional healers, the true traditional healers, They would go to the wild and harvest the plants themselves. They feel, because a lot of, especially people who are who have herbal training and also have, I call it a gift of divine sort of this intervention. They would prefer to dream about these plants and go and harvest those plants wherever they've seen them. And normally a traditional healer then would prescribe it to a patient. But there's a problem with all of this because it's so based on the whole trade. I've had lots of discussion with different traditional healers on this, that the whole trade, medicine is a very sacred thing. It's according to African spiritual belief. You're not supposed to, medicine is not supposed to be exposed to certain people at certain times. Medicine is not supposed to be harvested at certain times. And here are these plants, they displayed there the whole day in the sun, a lot of people passing with different energies. It doesn't make quite sense, you know, in that if that they follow. But people, because they are more urbanized, they overlook a lot of those things and they say, no, I want that plant, I think that plant will, you know. They don't go for the whole holistic effect that the plant has an energy, which a lot of the traditional healers who are more hardcore believe. So this I've put this table together to try and explain without confusing on certain things. Obviously, did three categories, like what I've said before, the African traditionalist, Chinese. I've added a bit of Buddhist and European Christianity to compare, because you'll see later on why I've decided to really compare these three initially, because I wanted to establish certain things. Most traditional Africans believe on their ancestral biological lineage. So they believe, for an example, that your father, when they die, they become an ancestor, and when you die, you become an ancestor to your children. So what do these ancestors do? These ancestors, they believe that they bring good fortune. Sometimes they can withheld good fortune to people. So now and then, how people would relate to them, they would, in order to relate to them, they would always slaughter a cow, a goat, sheep, chicken, depending what's the occasion. They would light impepho, and impepho, which is a incense, and open that dialogue. Why I'm comparing this? This is very much based. I wanted to highlight that in Africa, a lot of the people think they believe in this biological lineage, although they believe in God. They believe in this biological lineage of their ancestor, that their ancestors, through them, they will not necessarily go to heaven, although they don't believe in heaven. They believe going to their ancestors, which are called Amatonga, Amadlozi, and that they give them good fortune. Also, Buddhist and Christianity, God is an abstract concept. Although there is, a meeting place, especially in Christianity, that you go through through Jesus Christ to through you can access God through Jesus Christ. So, which is contrary to what the African traditional belief is. And I also wanted to compare the place of worship and so on. Most Africans traditionally, they would go to their house. They have a special place in their house called Msamo, where they'll pray. They'll do all their traditional ceremonies. And that's in an urban setting. But in a traditional setting, a lot of the things are done in the kraal. The kraal, as you know, is very central. If a man builds a house, they build it around the kraal. And they'll go and pray there. They'll slaughter there. They'll burn their impepo there. And Buddhists, they have temples. And the Christians have churches. And, of course, I spoke about how people pray and how they sacrifice. It's interesting enough, a lot of also Christianity is based on those pagan rituals, on sacrifice. If we go back to the Bible about sacrificing, Abraham sacrificing his firstborn, then it changed to an animal, then it changed to Jesus Christ. So how that philosophy has progressed in that sort of thinking. This, you know, all these cultures view the world as a transitional space. It's not a place that, you know, we will dwell here forever, but it's a transitional place. Like I said before, people's African tradition, they feel that you go to your ancestors, you don't, whereas Christians would believe that it's heaven or hell, and the Buddhists to another world. So I did, I think, touch a little bit on Sangomas and the practitioners on how they are, who they are earlier on. And Chinese, I wanted to stress that the approach here in Chinese, it's rather interesting that they've got, you know, all these other disciplines. Although we here in this room, I think a lot of us go to sort of modern Western, use modern Western medicine. A lot of us are not familiar with these five pillars that they use to, you know, get healthy. Although a lot of them also use Western medicine today. To get back to the plants, enough about the, you know, facts and now we'll start off with charm plants. Here in Africa, there's quite a few charms, but because this one is the most common one that you see, probably all of you have in your garden, the Clivia miniata. In isiZulu we call it umayime, which is used for a lot of things. When I say a charm plant, it's a plant that people believe that it can do certain things. They believe in them. They don't have to ingest it. Sometimes they do ingest it. Sometimes they can use it as a spray. Sometimes they can use it as a wash. But they believe that it has certain powers that can give them health, that can give them good fortune, that can give them all sorts of other things that they desire. So clivia is one of those plants that is used by mainly a lot of Xhosa-speaking, Zulu-speaking people as a good luck, good health charm. In China, this was taken in one of the biggest botanical garden, medicinal botanical garden, as they claim in China. The gods, you know, it's they are a symbol of a good health, and they are a symbol of purifying. So a lot of medicines in China come in these. They put them in these. And it symbolizes that it's a charm, but it's also a vessel that they put plants in, their medicines in. Also, this is an interesting plant. This plant, a peony, in Europe for a long time, actually, until about maybe 200 years ago, two hundred and fifty years ago, it was believed to cure epilepsy. So people would put their roots around the neck, and you know, for a long time, it was believed to cure epilepsy. Incense in Africa, we like this. We use this Helichrysum odoratissimum, but not necessarily only this species. That's odoratissimum, which means it's got quite an odor. I have one for you here. I'll pass the three different types of mbepo that you can smell and sample as we talk. They are very pungent. Incense are common in all these cultures. They I like to say, set the tone, set the mood. You find them in a lot of first in any every traditional ceremony in Africa. You'd find them that also always like to set the tone, the mood. And if we go to China, a lot in the temples of Buddhists, they light them. A lot of also their traditional belief, because there is, China is such a vast place. Not everyone believes in the same thing, which I must point out that a lot of people in China are actually a-religious. They're not religious. And they would use, this is what they would use, the agar wood, mixed with other things, depending on the region, of course. And in Europe, I've also passed this frankincense. I always get this wrong, this word wrong, Frankenstein, sometimes I say. So I've passed that. A colleague of mine from Oman was here last year, and he brought me that Boswellia saccharum. And you can eat it as well. It tastes quite nice, but you can burn it as well as in pepper. And a lot of the churches, they burn a mixture of that and myrrh as well. And as well, it's mentioned in the Bible. We get to another grouping of plants, which are purgatives. These are very common in all these cultures. The purgatives also, which is related, the emetics. If you read a lot of Victorian literature, you'll see a lot of Victorians as well, they were very interested in using purgatives and emetics. And also here in Africa, people still use them quite a bit. The most common one that you recognize on your everyday life is the aloe, arborescence. But it also varies according to your region, where you are. This is also used for not only humans, for animals as well. Another very, very well-known one. I know my grandmother gave me this when I was young. Resinous communist, the castor oil. One common one. And also rhubarb. That's also used in China. Now, some plants that are also common in these cultures, the plants that are used as hallucinogenic plants. Here in Africa, especially in South Africa, this is a growing trend. This plant, Katha edulis, we have Katha edulis is found from here in the Southern Africa right up to central beginning of West Africa. And it's growing in use. In fact, I was, I think, not so long ago, I was at the Botanical Garden in Pietermaritzburg in KwaZulu-Natal. And because we have different nationalities that come from different parts of Africa, and they use these plants elsewhere, you're finding that people who come from different countries, like in Central Africa, they would use those plants, and now they see them here, and they start educating people here, and they start using them. So this plant, Katha edulis, the use of it here in Southern Africa is growing. In some places, I've heard that it's becoming quite a problem where it occurs. In the botanical garden there where I went, because I wanted to see and photograph it, it had no leaves whatsoever. The leaves, so I couldn't photograph the plant. So, some plants that is used as a plant like that, a hallucinogenic plant as well. This Yansha Fabaceae bush, Cisalpina. And of course, we know this plant. It's very, very, very popular plant, known throughout the world, and very problematic plant, but also had a lot of, in the 1800s, mid-1800s, late-1800s, a lot of breakthrough with this plant, with morphine, codeine, which is was extracted from this plant, the poppy. And to get to another interest that people really like to explore in all cultures is aphrodisiacs. Obviously, people want to be, you know, our primary instinct is to reproduce, is to have children, is to attract the opposite partner. And these plants are still very popular in different parts. This is very popular in especially Limpopo and going up to Central Africa. It grows right up to Central Africa. They call it impesu in Sipedi and Chivenda. It's an interesting tree. In China again, if we go back to China, ginseng, although you can buy it in any chemist these days, also as a used as an aphrodisiac to boost libido, to and so on. And Europe, the verbena still used, and although some of these medicines now they've been packaged, they are not used as raw as I showed you earlier on. Things that I won't go into detail because of the time. Plants also that one could further investigate, you could go and look it up, that are often associated with shape. If a plant has got a certain morphological characteristic thus can be used for that. I'll make an example. There's a very famous plant called Casteria. One of my mentors, Arends van Asveld, worked on it for his master's. And that plant is very well camouflaged. So a lot of people along the eastern coast, they always believe that, you know, when you go to war, you wash with that plant, and those properties will sort of rub off you. And also the last, the understated effects of placebo. Placebo is a very, very powerful thing. I mean, it's used in all cultures. A lot of the medicine that actually is taken, most of it in traditional medicine, although this is a bit of a controversial statement when I say it, a lot of it has got to do with psychology. A lot of people, when they take it, they believe that they're going to get healed, and they get healed. Thank We are fortunate that we can test the efficacy of these medicine. But I think there's a lot of work also to be done in this area to see how placebos really and the power of our minds and so on. To end off, you know, is that knowledge, traditional knowledge is a very important thing. Like I said, we have this 25% plants that are prescribed. All those plants, the knowledge didn't just come from just pure science or academic research from scratch. It had to start from somewhere. It had to start from people who were using plants, and someone who was interested in that went and tested the efficacy of those plants and say, oh, we can use this product for this, we can use this product, this active ingredient could be useful for this. So it's very important that we continue preserving the indigenous knowledge, but not at the expense of the environment. We have to come up with smarter ways, clever ways of, using plants. In the last 10 years or so, we've been trying to promote those plants. At Kirstenbosch, we have a lot of the plants that grow in the useful plants are available for sale. We've gone around at different places of Southern Africa collecting these plants to try and make them available, their seeds, the cuttings, and so on. Thank you very much.